From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. High drama over talking with the Taliban this week, and so far, it's not happening. The Taliban was happy to strut its stuff in Doha, Qatar, acting like a government in waiting. Washington's ally in Kabul, President Hamid Karzai, went nuts over that. The U.S. wants out, mostly, and needs the Taliban to do that. This hour On Point, talking and fighting and talking with the Taliban. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Does the U.S. need the Taliban to get out of Afghanistan? Will the Taliban live with any government the United States leaves behind? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Doha, Qatar, is Rod Nordland, correspondent for the New York Times. Based in Kabul, this week across the Arabian Sea in Doha, covering the drama over talks. Rod Nordland, welcome back to On Point.
My pleasure.
Hey, why does the United States, for one, want to, need to talk to the Taliban?
Well, I think they've said for a long time now that they don't think there can be any solution in Afghanistan without a political settlement, that nobody is going to win it militarily. And so they see that as their best guarantee that they won't be mired there indefinitely in the future. They're in talks with the Afghan government over what kind of force, what size force, and I don't think the president's really decided on that yet either, the president of the United States, but what kind of force they'll leave after 2014, at which point we will have been there a decade and a half. And I think they realize unless there's a political settlement, we could easily be there two or three decades hence.
Why should then the Taliban want to talk to the United States, or for that matter, even to the government in Kabul?
Well, I think as we've seen these last couple of days, talking to the United States gives them legitimacy, and opening an office here in Qatar gives them a certain amount of international legitimacy, and they're playing that for all it's worth, which is why the Afghans are furious. It's not at all clear yet if they're going to actually condescend to speak to the people they deride as puppets in Afghanistan.
Rod, describe what happened in Doha that got President Hamid Karzai so bent out of shape this week.
Well, it was a lot of things. I mean, it coalesced around some images, and images in this kind of thing are very important. Those images were a banner that said Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which is the name the Taliban had for their government when they were in power, and, of course, what they still call themselves in exile, and a Taliban flag that they hoisted. And to the Afghans, that made it look like they were opening up an embassy, and the deal was explicitly on all sides. They thought that was only going to be an office where to provide what they said was an address, a place to actually go and see and talk to the Taliban about one issue only, peace. The Taliban, in addition to their symbology, they expanded that greatly and started describing their office as, in effect, an embassy, a place where they would meet with diplomats from other countries, where they would meet with international officials and talk to the press and so on.
Did they back off of the theater of almost government in waiting? Have they piped down on that or not?
Well, they sort of backed off. It's interesting. Last night, I just arrived here last night. I went straight over there, and the banner was gone, saying Islamic Emirate. There was no sign of the flag, and so it looked like they had quickly acquiesced to those terms. However, today, it turns out all they did take the banner off. So from the outside, you can't see the banner and you can't see the flag. But what they did was they actually cut the flagpole shorter so they could lower the flag behind their own wall. So if you peer through a crack in the wall, you can see the flag, and it's still there, but it's not visible to the general public. So I guess they felt that was a compromise.
Oh, boy, but it's still up there just on a shorter flagstaff. Who was supposed to talk this week exactly, Rod? Taliban, the U.S., was the Kabul government going to sit down here as well or not?
No, if the first step was that the Americans would talk to them, and that would probably have been James Dobbins, who's the president's envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the point man in all this. And the thought was that the expectation was that he would be here today to begin these talks, and the first round of talks would probably be confidence building measures in which We would discuss releasing some Taliban prisoners from Guantanamo, and the Taliban would promise to hand over their only POW, you know, specialist Bergdahl and Bo Bergdahl. And everyone has understood that those would be the first steps. Then the Afghan government and the American government expect that the Afghan officials would visit shortly after that, like within days of that, to enter into discussions with the Taliban. On that, they've been a little bit less clear. The Taliban have been a little bit less clear about whether they would really start doing that and start doing it right away, which is another sticking point. But we haven't even got that far. We're right still now on, you know, whether they have a flag and whether they're calling themselves an embassy or not.
So when the Taliban in Doha, in Qatar, started acting like a government in waiting, at least to Kabul's perception, President Hamid Karzai shut everything down in a hurry. What was his leverage that allowed him to do that, Rod?
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, actually. The leverage that he used was ongoing bilateral security talks with the United States. These are the talks that would hopefully, from the Afghan and American government's points of view, lead to some sort of residual military force and training force and also financing for the Afghan military after 2014 when the Americans, for the most part, leave. And the Afghans very much want that. The Americans want it too, but the Afghans need a lot more. Karzai broke that off. Now, when I say it's ironic, you know, the demand of the Taliban has always been, we won't talk to the Afghan government until there are no foreign forces left in Afghanistan. So in a way, I mean, Karzai, by breaking off, talks off with Americans, may actually, in an ironic way, improve the conditions somewhat for talking to the Taliban.
Is Washington's presumption that eventually the Taliban would actually accept an ongoing U.S. military troop presence after 2014, a long-term presence, that the Taliban would go for that?
No, I don't think they do think that. I think that they, although...
But that's what they're asking, you know, that's what they're asking Karzai for, right?
That's what they're asking Karzai for, but I think they expect that it would take some years of negotiations to make a deal with the Taliban, and then part of that deal would be that there wouldn't, by that point, there wouldn't be any American troops left. And I don't think it's really plausible that the Taliban would make a deal unless they could see the back of American forces in Afghanistan.
Rod, how many American troops are in Afghanistan now, and what's the step-down schedule? Is there one toward the end of 2014?
There isn't one yet. No, it's 65,000, and then I think we review it again next February or something. Some ways down the road before we review it. There have been some decreases in that as units rotate and some units aren't replaced, but they've been pretty small. We've been kind of at that number, 65,000 for a while now, and I think the military hopes it will keep at that level through most of 2014.
And give us your sort of reality check on the reality of the possibility of some future Afghanistan state where the, let's call it the Karzai government and the Taliban share power or, you know, somehow govern together. Is that real possibility or is that just dreaming?
Well, I mean, you have people that hate each other sharing power in other countries. I mean, in Bosnia, for instance, where Serbs and Muslims share power, although it's not a very happy union. I think some people think that maybe certain ministries could be given to the Taliban. And if the Taliban made certain compromises in their positions, and if they agreed to respect, say, issues and red lines, as they call them in the Constitution, such as women's rights, that maybe there would be a modus vivendi.
A geographic division? Is that possible here? Or, you know, they each sort of run different parts of the country?
I don't think that anyone would ever agree to that, although that may well happen de facto on the ground, depending how the war goes. I mean, mm-hmm. You could see a scenario where the Taliban come to dominate, you know, the south and the east if the Afghan military isn't able to hold those areas as foreign troops leave. So you might have some sort of de facto separation of the country. I think you have to remember, though, that Afghanistan has been within its more or less its modern borders for
long
many
time.
Centuries.
Yes.
A lot longer than most countries have. And despite their differences and ethnic divisions and so on, it's been one country, you know, for better or worse.
The U.S. went in the first place because of the attacks planned and executed out of Afghanistan on 9/11. Is the Taliban convincingly saying that they won't host that kind of terrorism outside the country again?
Well, that was the precondition for this office. They had to make a statement, which they did, disavowing any support for international terrorism from the soil of Afghanistan. And they made that statement, but they did not mention the word al-Qaeda, which is what the Americans want to see them move to. They want to see an explicit break with al-Qaeda. And their statement stopped somewhat short of that. It said they wouldn't want to use their territory for supporting international terrorism. Well, they have made that statement before. In fact, they made that statement in 2001 and, you know, before 9/11 occurred. Easy to make statements like
sure.
that. It would be a lot harder for them to actually publicly denounce or break with al-Qaeda. You know, when Osama bin Laden was killed, there was a big debate that went on among the Taliban. It took them like a couple days to decide what their response would be, and their response was to deplore the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Just got a second here, Rod. Are there expectations that these talks will get up and on the rails again in the next couple of days, or who knows?
I think a lot of people are scurrying around trying to make that happen, but I personally think it may well take more than just a few days.
Rod Nordland is correspondent for the New York Times, based in Kabul, in Doha, Qatar today, joining us. Rod, thank you very much for your time and insights.
You're welcome.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about talks with the Taliban over the future of Afghanistan, the blow-up, the drama in Doha, Qatar this week, the cases for and against Taliban talks, where they might lead, when and if they actually get off the ground. Here's the sound of the Taliban in Doha. This was on Tuesday, saying that they're as strong as ever and they're not going to be going anywhere.
The last decade, the 12 years fighting in which America and all allies, they tried to defeat this power, but the result is our power is increased.
The Taliban talking big in Doha, Qatar, there with Al Jazeera English. President Obama had encouraged these talks on Wednesday after Afghan's President Karzai expressed his anger. There was a press conference in Berlin where the U.S. president was alongside German President Angela Merkel talking about how this is all going. It won't be easy, said Obama.
We don't expect that it will be easy, but we do think ultimately we're going to need to see Afghans talking to Afghans about how they can move forward and end the cycle of violence there so that they can start actually building their country.
We're going to dive right on in here, looking at these talks, when and how and where they might actually get up on the rails, what would come out of them, whether this is the way to a stable Afghanistan without such a big American presence. Joining us right now from Kabul in Afghanistan is Yanis Koskinas. He's author of Reconciliation Philosophy, Fishing Without Bait. It's the case of more or less against negotiating with the Taliban in foreign policy. He's executive VP at the Asia-Africa Projects Group, former Air Force colonel who's been deeply involved in all this for a long time, was a special advisor to General Stanley McChrystal. Yanis Koskinas in Kabul, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be with you.
And with us from Washington is Daniel Markey, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, specializes in security and governance in South Asia, worked in the State Department as a South Asia policy planner from 03 to 07, been right in the middle of all this, author of the forthcoming book, No Exit from Pakistan, America's Torture Relationship with Islamabad. Daniel Markey, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Yanis, you're right there in Kabul. You've been in the middle of this for a long time. What do you see happening in the tussle this week over talks with the Taliban?
Well, obviously, I think most people would agree that this has been an embarrassment for the American side. They certainly did not want to see President Karzai react this way. But I think people who have been looking at this problem for a long time would realize that external entities can sort of facilitate certain things, but they can't actually set the terms or actually even the agenda to some regard. So you can't call it an Afghan-led process and then have what happened yesterday effectively put something on the books that embarrasses the U.S. effort and in some ways makes it more difficult.
Does the U.S. need the Taliban? Do they have to talk to them? Do they need the Taliban's cooperation to wrap this up as envisioned, Yanis?
I think they do. I absolutely think they do. But we need to do it quietly. We don't need to be in center stage. I think the idea is to get the Afghan government and beyond the Afghan government, the Afghan people to discuss this, to form some sort of national consensus, to actually consider some kind of reconciliation between Afghan entities, not a U.S.-led enterprise as it sort of made it look that way. The other thing, and you know, Rod is a great news reporter, journalist,
yeah.
And he, I agree with what he said earlier. The one thing that I would point out is that, you know, 2014 is not just the year that the U.S. and the coalition are exiting. It's also the year that you have elections in Afghanistan. So the whole time leading to that next president coming to power, or even the debate up to that time frame, needs to include reconciliation. And the peace conversations are now stalled in some ways. And I agree with Rod. I think it's going to take more than a few days to get back on track because there are feelings that are hurt. And my Afghan colleagues that I've been talking to here and around the world are absolutely incensed about this.
Daniel Markey, Americans of a certain age will remember peace talks around Vietnam decades ago now. And, of course, we all know what happened there. The United States talked with their then enemies in the north, and as soon as the U.S. was gone, those enemies who were opposed to the American-supported government in the south took over. Is this a parallel situation? Are we talking with the Taliban, and once we're gone or reduce our forces, that it's just theirs?
Sadly, there are important parallels to be drawn, and I think the critical feature to recognize here is the Taliban as a political movement inside of Afghanistan has not shown itself willing to compromise politically, at least not in the past. And if they stick to their guns, as they have in the past, and as their recent statements suggest, declare a certain victory out of this negotiating process, then what comes in the future is a situation where they will continue to press their advantage. And so if you crack the door open a little bit, there is a reasonable fear that they'll keep pushing it further and further open, and eventually they will assert themselves fully inside of Kabul. Whether that comes about in a matter of a year or two or five or ten, it's still a legitimate concern to have.
Does power sharing somewhere down the road look like a realistic possibility to you, or like a kind of fiction that the Americans are hiding behind while they prepare to go?
Well, power sharing of some kind is probably going to have to happen. The question is whether the other power players in Afghanistan can firm up their positions in a way that allows them to negotiate from a greater position of strength. And so, you know, if the Taliban themselves are going to be pushing for their advantage in every possible way, the other participants in the Afghan side of the political dialogue also need to be pushing their advantage. So the only way that you get a kind of a staple equilibrium, probably a messy one, perhaps even a bloody one, but an equilibrium of sorts in Afghan politics, is if the various sides also have a reasonable capacity to assert themselves. And that's not what you saw back in the Vietnam case. And it's not something that you'd necessarily get to negotiate through simply a diplomatic dialogue. It's something that would be more of a, as we're seeing, a fight and talk arrangement, but one that persists well beyond the point where the United States will effectively be removed from the scene, or at least will draw down its military far below where it is now.
Yanni Koskinas there in Kabul, it was just this week on Tuesday that the NATO coalition, American-led, formally, officially transferred security responsibility for all of Afghanistan to government forces. Does that mean that they now have the stuff to stand up and stay stood up as NATO forces retreat from Afghanistan so the Taliban has to deal with them rather than just running over them?
Well, first of all, I mean, I find it ironic that at first, until I saw the briefing online from the White House. I thought, you know, how could we possibly have the same day that you have the security transition the Doha opening of the Taliban? I found it fascinating, you know, almost what a horrible timing. But then I read online basically that this was actually roughly an expected time frame. Now that may be just the way it's portrayed, but the fact is that it's unfortunate that it happened, because the security transition is an important step. I think that has always been sort of the game plan of, as coalition, as Afghan security forces capability goes up, the drawdown of forces is going to happen from the coalition side. But I think the Afghans need a lot of enablers in terms of airlift, close air support, some logistics, in order to be able to do what they do. But their capabilities have been increasing, so you have to take that into account. But the biggest thing that is keeping, in my opinion, the Taliban or the other insurgent groups like Hizb Islami, that still adheres, the militant arm of it that still adheres to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and the Haqqani network that ostensibly is under the Taliban, and also other criminal elements, is a lack of governance. Unless the governance in Afghanistan actually improves, then you're going to have a much more difficult time with the insurgent groups, because they have some kind of support in some of the areas around Afghanistan. So to put it back together, I mean, yes, the capabilities have been going up for the Afghan side. They still need a lot of help, but this is making it more difficult, what we're doing right now.
Yanni Koskinas, Daniel Markey, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in here. Eric is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Eric, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I saw a report an hour and a half ago from The Guardian that the talks have been canceled between the U.S. and the Taliban.
Well, that's true, but they're hoping, I think, to revive them within the next couple of days. Does it look like the right idea to you, Eric?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, we've always had the stance of getting a terrorist, but...
I think we're losing Eric there. Let me get another call right here from Dundee, New York. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I just wanted to point out, I've just written an article on Afghanistan and the Taliban's role. And from the very beginning, we helped create the Taliban. I think a lot of people don't realize that, with Pakistan. They never existed before.
You mean in opposition to the Soviets back in the day when they were occupying
exactly.
Afghanistan? Yeah, of course.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And with Al-Qaeda, too, although they were separate, they, because the Taliban were Pashtun,
yep.
As is Karzai, exactly. So they're also fighting over Pashtunistan there. But my point being that we courted them until 2001 from the beginning, trying to get them to stabilize Afghanistan so a pipeline could be run from Turkmenistan, called Tappy, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan,
yeah.
Pakistan, and India to the sea, where they would have access to getting the gas and oil out. And they had hoped that the Taliban would be the ones to stabilize them. We brought the Taliban, or they came to Texas to talk to the oil companies early on, and then they were courted by the Clinton administration.
Sure.
By the Bush administration.
And it all worked until it didn't. I want to pick that up. You raise important history here, Steve, and I appreciate it. Daniel Markey, let me bring that one first to you. There was a time when we were very close to the precursors of the Taliban, Mujahideen. Do we still have relations going back to those old anti-Soviet days, or is it all new crew in there now, Daniel?
Well, I think it's important that we not overstate the ties between the current generation of Afghan Taliban mm-hmm. and the past. There has been a lot of change. Even the generation of Taliban under Mullah Omar that was in charge of Afghanistan at the time of 9/11 was different in important ways from the guys that we had done business with in the 80s. And now we're seeing, I think, and this is an important piece of the challenge of reconciliation, we're seeing a next generation of Afghan Taliban, the fighters that have emerged over the past decade, who may or may not be entirely willing to accept orders from the central Taliban command. If a deal or some sort of deal were beginning to be struck, one can imagine a situation where hardliners within the Afghan Taliban who have come up over the past decade would flat out reject it and believe that they could do better by sticking to their guns. So, you know, the history is very important, and the caller is right to remind us of U.S. connections dating back certainly decades and in some ways longer than that. But there are important differences that have emerged over the years as well.
Yanni Koskinas, in Kabul, our caller reminds us of that history. The United States in the past has lived with the Taliban. Now, that was pre-9/11. Could the U.S. do that again? President Obama is careful to say that the target is al-Qaeda. Could the U.S. live with a Taliban-ruled Afghanistan post-9/11, all these years after, in a period of withdrawal?
I mean, paying attention to history is incredibly important, and the caller is exactly right. So is Daniel with his assessment, so I won't revisit that. But I'll just say this. The Taliban actually sent envoys prior to 9/11 to the U.S. to talk about this bin Laden problem. So that's documented. It's there. Maybe it was low level, or maybe it wasn't high level enough. But they're not somebody the al-Qaeda piece, I don't think they were a guest of the Taliban here. I think they realized their mistake in allowing them to stay. I think they had a problem and they didn't exactly know how to deal with it at one point. But the fact is that the Taliban were part of an enterprise, the Mujahideen, that threw out the Soviets. So, yes, there are those connections. I think there are still some connections between Mujahideen that have joined the government and perhaps people that are that they used to fight against the Soviets. And maybe we should exploit those sort of connections. But eventually, I think we have to look at the fact that when you throw al-Qaeda in the mix, I find it very distasteful that we're still even talking with anybody that is sort of not going to oppose al-Qaeda openly.
And yet we're doing exactly that, or trying to, in Doha.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, I served in the military. I put people in harm's way. And quite honestly, I've been to too many Arlington Cemetery events to have those families that have to deal with their loss have to contend with some sort of statement like that. I find it very disturbing.
Daniel Markey, we just got half a minute before the break. Do you think that Hamid Karzai sitting there in Kabul saying, oh my heavens, the U.S. would be willing to throw me under the bus and let the Taliban come in? They could live with that. They're so determined to get out of here that they don't really care if it's Karzai or somebody else.
In a word, yes. I mean, Hamid Karzai has been of a mind to believe that the Obama administration has been willing to throw him under the bus basically since they came into office. There's not been a lot of love there, and there's not a lot of trust, and we're hearing a lot of that now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about talks with the Taliban over the future of Afghanistan. The blow up this week, the drama, the cases for and against Taliban talks, where this all stands. Daniel Markey joins us from Washington, D.C., was in the State Department in the middle of all this for years in the last decade. He's now with the Council on Foreign Relations. Yanis Koskinas joins us from Kabul, Afghanistan. He was a special advisor to General Stanley McChrystal, who was, of course, the top U.S. general there at a critical period in this long, long war. Former Air Force Colonel Yanni Koskinas, now with the Asia-Africa Projects Group. It's a for-profit business consulting on foreign investment in Afghanistan and beyond. this week as they put up their sign with their old name for Afghanistan and their old flag in Doha and got the current Kabul government all in a lather. They were talking nice about what they would or wouldn't do abroad. Here's a Mohammad Naeem, a Taliban spokesman, renouncing any threat to other countries from the Taliban, interpreted here by CNN from Doha.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, in addition to its military efforts, also has political goals and strategies related only to Afghanistan, which does not intend to cause harm to others and will not allow anyone to use Afghan soil to threaten the security of other countries because it wants, as a part of the mutual respect, to establish good relations with all world countries, particularly with neighboring countries.
Its political agenda relating only to Afghanistan. Translation, don't worry about us, you know, in lower Manhattan or anywhere in the United States. We've got lots of response here online. Daniel Yanni Saeed says the Taliban never abided by any truce or peace agreements with the Pakistanis. What makes you think they'll abide by an agreement with the infidels, i.e. Washington? Adam says, this is from Facebook, murderers of women, old men, children, trusting them with anything is a dangerous game. Jim says it's quite irresponsible for Americans to talk with these people. They're murderers. They'll only be completely satisfied when the entire world is Sunni. I see a Taliban takeover when the discussion ends. But Molly writes to us, I wish we had quit fighting the Taliban a long time ago. It has been a very, very long war. Yanni Kaskinas, what do you make of the Taliban spokesman's assurances there that the Taliban has no political agenda outside of Afghanistan? That is, don't worry about us in terror terms.
Well, first of all, you know, we keep labeling Taliban out there. There's probably insurgents are actually responsible for about 81% of the civilian casualties, not all of it being Taliban. But, you know, we have Taliban as the sort of the head of this insurgency. I think, look, the Afghans in general are pragmatic. I think the Taliban are pragmatic. All theatrics aside, I think that they are going to come to some sort of accommodation. The point is that the accommodation must take place with the Afghans. We can facilitate it, but the idea that we are going to engage with them, let's say on Thursday, and then the Afghan government is going to engage with them on Friday, is a bad approach forward. The Soviet-backed government of Najibullah had plenty of senior leaders from that regime that's actually part of the Afghan government today. So they are pragmatic. We just have to be very careful with the way that we approach these two groups.
Daniel Markey, Washington has been very clear that their number one interest here is not to be attacked again from this part of the world. Barack Obama has been very clear on that. But when and if they sit down in Doha, what could the Taliban say that would give them an actual assurance that we could believe in, that won't happen again? And what would American options be if the Taliban does take some kind of power position in Afghanistan and the U.S. is pulling down and out? You know, is American leverage gone if and when that should happen?
Right. You're pointing to the question of how the Taliban can really be a credible guarantors of any deal that they might craft. And the answer is they can't. All they can possibly do, they can say the right thing, which they haven't quite done yet. As was pointed out earlier, they haven't said that they would officially dump their relationship with al-Qaeda in particular. They've made general statements of the sort that they've made in the past. So the first thing they have to do is be very clear and very public about a divorce from al-Qaeda. That would be the kind of thing that would give the United States some confidence. And the reason that would offer a little bit of confidence is because that would be a somewhat risky move by the Taliban. They would basically be declaring al-Qaeda an enemy and exposing themselves to reprisals from al-Qaeda should al-Qaeda choose to launch them. So it's that kind of a costly signal that the United States would first be on the lookout for. And then, of course, time will tell. And really, the only way that you can possibly defend, I think, in strategic terms, the opening of this dialogue comes in the category of we've tried just about everything else. It hasn't worked particularly well. There's been a recognition that eventually some sort of a political settlement will have to come to Afghanistan. It's better to get this kind of talking going sooner rather than later. U.S. leverage in the region is diminishing, not growing. Mm-hmm. And so let's move this along. Of course, it would have been nice under that logic to have had this dialogue begin 18 months ago or so when it was first discussed. But here we are.
Here we are. Joanne in Augusta, Georgia. Joanne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling to say something very similar to the person whose email you just read.
Mm-hmm.
I think that compromise with the Taliban is the same thing as trying to compromise with Hitler in the beginning of World War II. These folks have their whole creed is lie for Islam, lie if you need to. So you can't trust anything they say. They can say all kinds of things, but just like in Egypt when they said they weren't going to run for president and then they did. And next thing you know, we have people, in fact, I just met some who are from Egypt who are now...
Sure, they're in office. Joanne, let me ask you, what's the alternative here? We don't talk to the Taliban and we just stay there? Or what?
Well, I think that the Afghani people are going to have to make a complete stand against Al-Qaeda. They have to do that themselves. They're going to have to do it themselves eventually. And what's happened is there's still currently forces in Afghanistan who want the Taliban on their side. All of the groups that are the dissident groups, you know, that are trying to... The rebel groups, whatever,
yep.
They need to come to a decision that they will not have anything to do with the Taliban.
Well, of course, Taliban's woven in pretty deeply, but we will pick that up, Joanne, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, and we'll go to it. Tanya in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Tanya, thank you for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I only have 2 seconds. I'm running into a meeting,
okay.
so I'll take any comments off the air.
Yeah.
I agree wholeheartedly with the previous caller, and I'd like to add that I'm, as a woman, incensed that my government is talking to the Taliban. You know, over 51% of the population of the United States is female, and our taxpayer money was used in Afghanistan to fight that war. And for the result of all of that lies, all the lives and treasure that was lost, to then be negotiating with a murderous, misogynistic group of hooligans is beyond belief, and that my government would be part of that is really...
But how long should we stay to stand up for Afghan women? It's been way more than a decade already, Tanya. How long?
Well, I think that in terms of moving out, the other point that I wanted to make is that I think it's time for a new paradigm in terms of, on an international level, who we invite to the table to negotiate with and to set up, you know, a transitional government. Why is it always the hooligans that are invited to the table? Why is it the murderers that are invited to the table? Why, internationally, I think we need to be more creative in our thinking and invite women's groups to the table to negotiate, a final settlement. In these wars, there in Afghanistan and the Sudan, all over the world, the people who are suffering the most are the women.
Yeah, it's easy to imagine it being very ugly for a lot of women if the Taliban really comes to power. Tanya, I appreciate your call as well. Daniel Markey, Yanni Koskinas, let's pick these up, starting with Joanne, you know, who's saying the Afghan people need to take a stand against the Taliban. Does that make sense as a sentence to you, Daniel? Or are a lot of the Afghan people supporting the Taliban?
Well, I think it is important to recognize that the Taliban as a movement are not broadly popular as far as we can tell in Afghanistan. In fact, most Afghans are against the Taliban. Their ability, however, to stand up against the Taliban has been limited by their poverty and by their lack of organization and political institutions. And as Yanni has pointed out, it's also been limited by the corruption and ineffectiveness of the Afghan government in Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been their handicap, and that continues. But I think both of the callers are making a set of reasonable arguments about why any political process should not simply be directed at cutting a deal with the worst elements in this conflict, but has to also include the broadest possible range of participation from within Afghanistan. And there have been efforts to do that, but I think we need to recognize that this one dialogue is only a piece of a broader political puzzle that includes Afghan national elections and includes a lot of other dialogues and consultations, both with women's groups and other non-governmental organizations, as well as other political parties. That's sort of been hidden by the way the news media has characterized this latest story. But all of that is ongoing and has to be ongoing. So this has to just be a piece of that broader puzzle.
Let me get a call from Mike in Pikeville, Kentucky, and I want to come to stay on this issue. But Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, we've heard for over a decade that we have to train the Afghans to be able to fight, and I've never bought the story. And I think a lot of Americans and a lot of NATO fighters and Afghan fighters have died while we've supposedly been training them up. They learned they've been fighting for 40 years. I believe they have the ability to fight, but I don't believe they've ever had the willingness to fight for a cause that we in the West could support. And as far as talking to the Taliban, I don't see what it could hurt to talk to somebody, but on the other hand, I don't see what we would have to gain by talking to the Taliban, leaving the Afghan government out of it. Talking's a lot better than shooting, I think.
Yeah, Mike, I appreciate your call. Of course, the Afghan government's supposed to get into it at some point, but this week they haven't been very warm toward it. That's for sure. We're talking about talking with the Taliban. Yanni, how about it? Our caller, Mike, says, look, this whole idea that we have to train Afghans to fight, he says they've been fighting for 40 years. Of course, they've been fighting much longer than that. Why is it that all of a sudden, in this century, it requires American training? We can see a lot of Afghans being pretty effective, giving U.S. troops plenty of trouble, from the other side. Why not those in support of Karzai?
Well, look, I mean, from the beginning of our latest involvement in Afghanistan since 2001 or two, what Afghanistan has needed was some money, some military assistance, and a lot of leadership. What they've gotten is quite a bit of money, at least lately, quite a bit of assistance. And what they haven't had is a lot of leadership in terms of how to deal and address some of these problems. A couple hundred special forces and air power supported people, defeated the Taliban in 2001. And now 160,000 troops from the coalition and 350,000 from the Afghan side, and they're having a hard time with this. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me that we are discussing dealing with the Taliban and actually allowing them some sort of governance when
I'm losing Yanni Koskinas there in Kabul for a second. You're breaking up, but I think we've got the drift. Let me get one more call here. Ross in Boston. Ross, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
After listening to all the calls, it just shows that people do not understand the Afghan people. It's not a people as a nation. It's a bunch of tribes. The Taliban started off when they were a group of students rescuing women from a warlord. That's how the Taliban began, and then they went into their policies. I'm not saying their policies are right. I'm an Afghan veteran. I've seen firsthand what they do. But until we decide how to understand a nationality or tribes, we will never be able to understand. And therefore, if we can negotiate, there's too many lives have been lost. It's time to call it a day. And just like the British Empire, the Soviets, the Greeks, the Macedonians, everyone who's gone through there, Afghans are sponge. It just soaks up the blood, and then it moves on.
Time to go. Ross, I appreciate your call. Daniel Markey, if we do, what about our caller Tanya's concern about Afghan women? The U.S. has been there a long time and has made some big statements along the way about what it was going to do for the Afghan people. What about women under a returned Taliban, even if it's power sharing? What does it suggest?
Well, I think that some version of power sharing is at least conceivable, which would allow Taliban to have control over certain ministries or devolve certain parts of the country de facto, as it's been described, to Taliban leadership. In any of those instances, however, the plight of women will be worse than it has been than it is now. And so I think that it's always been a central piece of kind of a fiction as the United States has moved ahead with the idea of negotiating with the Taliban, that we can have our cake and eat it too, that we can have sort of an honorable way out of this conflict on our chosen timetable and still preserve some of the gains that we've seen over the past decade. That's a very, very difficult thing to do. And if anything, I think that the United States would be better placed if it recognized that this political dialogue had to be seen in the context of a long-term commitment and, to some extent, a military commitment to Afghanistan. That's not the way that it is right now, mm-hmm. And so the hypocrisy is apparent.
Yanni, we just got half a minute here. What about the Taliban outside Afghanistan, the Haqqani network allies in Pakistan? I mean, are we going to talk to the Taliban on one side of the border, on the other side of the border, have it come back and bite us?
It's possible. It is absolutely possible. But I'll tell you this as a parting comment. When you're talking about power sharing and everything else, I think what we need to do is support the Afghan government today, support the Afghan government, particularly that's going to come to power in 2014. We need to give up the idea that we're going to settle this in 6 months. And we need to consider that this is a long-term commitment that does not involve 100,000 troops here. We are leaving. There is no doubt.
Yanni Kaskinas, I think we're getting that message. We appreciate you being with us today from Kabul, and Daniel Markey in Washington. Thanks to you both and our callers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.